This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And yes, this is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, your host, as usual, on Friday mornings. And today's guest, somebody we call upon every once in a while to help us understand something which usually looks like an impenetrable black box to most of us. And that, of course, is the National Assembly, the Parliament of South Africa. Marion Merton, of course, is our reigning and leading expert on what goes on there. And she writes about it for the Daily Maverick. And she's had a long career in journalism. And she knows everything there is to know about the National Assembly. And I suspect she knows all the secret hidey holes and rooms in the building. Well, it used to be the building. Now it's somewhere else, isn't it? Which is a problem. And she's the person we go to get an insight into what happens in this third branch of government. Some people would argue it supposedly should be called the first branch of government because that's where national authority ultimately resides. But nevertheless, it is true that Parliament gets less attention by the average citizen than I think it deserves because anything it does affects everybody else. In the last couple of days, I note that President Ramaphosa has signed four bills into law, and we'll talk about that. And there are 20-some more that are awaiting his final signature. The ones that have been signed include the Electoral Amendment Bill and the National Health Initiative, which now presumably are law, and Marion can explain how this all happened. The Parliament's just about ready to wrap up its current session, and the members are about ready to launch into their electioneering and campaign frenzy. And then, just as we thought it was going to be fairly straightforward, two events in the last couple of days. The Speaker of the House suddenly resigned under lots of pressure. Nosiviwe Mapisa Nakula, as she is accused of, and I use my favorite word here, financial shenanigans arose really during her time as Minister of Defense, as it says now in the newspapers. She resigned so that the ANC would be spared the embarrassment of defending her in the upcoming election. I don't know, maybe they should have to defend who she is before she resigned as well. Anyway, and then the committee that's been assigned to deal with the appointment or the selection of a new deputy public prosecutor is now in total turmoil when a new EFF MP, Usisiwe Mkhwebane, formerly the public protector, refused to recuse herself despite having known some of the candidates rather well. And that made it kind of a mess there. Meanwhile, the Parliament's supposed to be doing things like executive oversight, budget passage, investigations, and all that kind of useful stuff. And Marion, it's a pleasure to have you back. I saw you a few weeks ago in Cape Town. I promised you or threatened you, I guess, that we were going to do this again.
No, I always look forward to having a chat with you. Thank you, Brooks.
And, well, I mean, you know, you can explain all this to everybody. Where are we now? There's a temporary Speaker of the House. Appointment of the new deputy public prosecutor is stymied in some way, shape, or form. And there's lots of other business that simply hasn't happened yet. What's going on?
I think the quick way of saying it, it's all a bit of a mess, actually. And I think a lot of it has to do with rather extensive constituency periods that were allocated. Last year, for example, MPs went away for 10 weeks. Instead of that mid-year break used to be 2 or 3 weeks. For the last few years, it has been 10 weeks. And, you know, that takes time out of the parliamentary calendar. And traditionally, there's a rush towards the end of the year to finish up things. And of course, now it's been made worse because, oh dear, it's the end of a 5-year term. So somewhere along the line, time ran out and things are just taking too long. But I think the big thing is right now, National Assembly has an acting speaker. The deputy speaker, Tsenoli, Letshisa Tsenoli, has stepped up. He is now in acting capacity, leading the National Assembly, because, of course, as you said, Nosibibe Mapisa-Nqakula has resigned with immediate effect late on Wednesday evening because of all the corruption allegations against her. And, you know, on the 19th of March, we had the raid by the investigating directorate of the NPA. And, of course, on Thursday morning, everything kind of came to a head. She handed herself over to police and she appeared in the Pretoria Magistrates Court and was released on 50,000 rand bail. It's going to be interesting where it goes. But of course, by resigning, not only as Speaker of the National Assembly, but also as MP, Mapisa-Nqakula has now stepped away and basically saved Parliament and the ANC in Parliament a whole bunch of embarrassment, because, as you know, there was a motion of no confidence scheduled to be scheduled that the DA chief whip Siwewa Garube has requested, and of course there was also the ethics complaint in connection with the corruption allegations that she's now before the courts, a series of kickbacks, bribes solicited from a defense contractor. So it's not quite the ending of a parliamentary five-year term, I think, that a lot of people had in mind when the MPs were sworn in after the 2019 elections. It's complicated. However, the acting speaker is in place.
Let me just ask you this. The Speaker of the House in Britain, the Speaker of the House is supposed to be effectively nonpartisan and is the conductor of what amounts to the National Parliamentary Railroad, and, you know, calls things to order and make sure people don't hit each other too often. In the U.S., the Speaker of the House is avowedly partisan and is elected by the majority and acts on their behalf within reason. Here it seemed to be some sort of a somewhere in between those two models, presumably nonpartisan, but actually pretty partisan. But does that job actually have any real meaning or importance in a circumstance where party rule matters most of all?
It's an incredibly important job. Basically, if you are the Speaker of the National Assembly, you are basically the head of the legislative sphere of state. That basically means you are in the same position as the Chief Justice is the head of the judicial sphere of state, and the president is in charge of the executive sphere of state. So in terms of, you know, how governance comes together, it's an incredibly important position. It's been a nub, and you hit the nail on the head here quite nicely, and you opened the door to a tricky debate. Whoever gets appointed speaker, and it has in the past always been ANC MPs, they don't resign from the party. They maintain their ANC membership, and that has led to accusations of bias, certainly most recently by the EFF, but previously also by the DA and other opposition parties. You would have heard how it was particularly acute when Baleka Mbete was the speaker from 2014 until 2019, because at the time, Mbete was not only an ANC MP, but she was also the ANC national chairperson. So that is an executive party office. Look, the speaker is basically the authority that makes sure parliament runs. There are, of course, supportive structures like the table staff. Those are the people that, if you watch the parliamentary channel on, you will see those are the people that sit at the table in the black gowns and the white shirt. And if there's a moment, they will go advise the presiding officers. So they are also important. But in terms of anything that happens in parliament, annual reports, they get tabled and referred via the Speaker's office to the committees. If there's a petition that people want to submit to Parliament, it's addressed to the Speaker of the National Assembly and then is referred to wherever else in the institution it must go. In terms of the kind of administrative decisions, so where does Parliament see itself? What is the theme or what is the focus of a particular year? Those are the kind of decisions that are taken at the speakers and the NCOP chairperson's level. It should be done or with consultations of the political parties represented in Parliament. It should be done with input from the administration. Whether that always happens is, of course, a whole different debate that will keep us busy for days. So, no, it is a very important post.
I'm going to have to break for just a minute so we can do what we do on radio, which is app station IDs and commercials and sponsors' messages. But when we come back, we're still going to be speaking with Marion Merton, parliamentary whiz. And I'm going to ask her, having said what she just said about the way in which the speaker is supposed to function, put your mind around the question of what's going to happen if there is not a majority party per se in the parliament. This is Brooke Spector, The Deep Dive, and we'll be back in a minute.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and my guest today is Marion Merton, who, as listeners to this program probably know, is our reigning parliamentary whiz, who understands what happens with that collection of people who can be seen shouting at each other, waving pieces of paper, and somehow creating national law. I posed the question just before the break that you described the role of the speaker as and the way they have to function. But when there is no, if there is no national leading majority party, what in the world is going to happen?
That's the question we're all waiting to see the answer to after the elections. Nobody knows. The bottom line, it will really depend on the outcome of the elections. For example, if the ANC should return with a majority, I'm pretty sure what has happened in 2019 and 2014 and 2009 and 2004 and 1999 will happen again. The ANC having the majority members in the House will ensure that their person gets to be speaker. What you're alluding to is, of course, what everybody is trying to get their heads around. What happens if there is a coalition? Will one of the things, whether that's an ANC-led coalition on the one side, or whether that is maybe an opposition, current opposition parties-led coalition under the multi-party charter, it kind of doesn't matter. But the important thing is that whichever way it goes, if there is not a majority party, the speaker's position will be one of those key positions that will be negotiated about in the aftermath of the 29 May elections, depending on how the results go. For example, if the ANC is looking to a coalition or cooperation partners, they may very well say, we would like to have the president. That will be President Cyril Ramaphosa for a second term. However, to whoever is discussing cooperation, we can give you the speaker's position. The same thing will apply on the other side of the House. Within the MPC, if they're having enough votes or if they can put together a government, they will say, okay, Party X, IFP maybe, you can have the speaker's position. We, the IFP, or the Freedom Front Plus, we will be the presidential candidate. So it sounds really quite crass and quite blunt, but that is some of the politicking and the political brinkmanship that will unfold should a coalition or cooperation agreements be necessary. And unfortunately, it goes the world over. Positions like the speaker, like the president, a certain number of cabinet positions, for example, maybe even a combination of national positions like the speaker and provincial positions, all of that will be up for discussion, for debate. And remember, the important thing is, if there is a need for a coalition or some sort of cooperative arrangement, literally the pressure will be on. There are 14 days by the Constitution. Once the election has been declared, and that's a formal ceremony that the IEC will have. 14 days within maximum are allowed. Then the National Assembly must meet. The MPs must be sworn in. First order of the day, so to speak, after the swearing in, will be to elect the speaker. That happens with the Chief Justice in charge. Once the speaker is elected, the speaker supervises the election of the deputy speaker. Once that's done, usually in the afternoon, the Chief Justice comes back and then the president is elected. So 14 days is not a long time. As you know, coalition governments say in Finland or in Germany or actually even in Belgium, they took weeks and weeks and even months to formalize. And by the Constitution, we have 14 days.
Now, what happens? Now we're going to go into we're going to enter the dark cavern now. What happens when the parties involved simply cannot reach agreement? In some countries, when that happens, there's a call for a new election and they start all over again, which is obviously very irritating to the electors and costs money and becomes enormously complicated. But if it on day number 15, if there is no agreement, there is no speaker and there is no governing coalition and no president elected, then what happens?
Another election will be called. That is the only option. Look, it is utterly, totally unprecedented. And I would think that our politicians would prefer to avoid a situation like that. However, if it really gets to that, the president, the old president, the before the election president, right, will then have to call another election within 90 days. That's it. And we will have to go back to casting ballots.
So in that 90-day period, then everybody stays where they were as acting or interim president, interim speaker, interim parliamentarian, interim everything.
And not quite, not interim, because you would have had all MPs sworn in, which basically means you have a competent parliament. Okay. And parliament remains competent until the eve of the election. So that we've got sorted. And I'm sure there's lots of clever and very intelligent and very experienced constitutional lawyers and experts. The understanding is that in terms of the executive, that then remains in place in terms of the constitution, because there needs to be continuity. I mean, you can't just not have government and parliament and anything. So the constitution is there. There is a process. There is a roadmap. It is absolutely and utterly unprecedented. And I, quite frankly, it doesn't matter which side of the aisle I'd sit on. I don't think, regardless of where politicians sit, I don't think they want to even go down that way. So quietly, people are talking, people are reaching out. Maybe they're having a coffee or a drink or a lunch, and there are discussions happening. Of course, all the politicians from either side of the house will deny such cooperation, outreach discussions are taking place. But I think everybody is keenly aware of that 14 days that is literally not negotiable.
We're speaking with Marion Merton, our resident guru of all things parliamentary. This is Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive, and we'll be right back after this message. Norwood Hypermarket invites you to join us Thursday, the 11th of April, for late-night shopping. There will be prizes to be won, music to enjoy, and a Pesach range to make you smile. Open till 8 p.m. See you all there. Norwood Hypermarket, the place to be.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host, as I am every Friday morning this time. And my guest today, Marion Merton, who is helping us try to figure out what Parliament is coping with as it reaches the end of its current term and heads off into an election. Let me return to some things I noted right at the outset, that there are a whole series of bills that were passed. Two of them are enormously controversial and consequential at the same time. The one, of course, is the Electoral Amendments Act, which, pardon me, but I've never quite figured out what's in it, and the National Health Initiative, which I don't think anybody quite understands what's in it yet, but we're all going to be affected by it. What are the implications of these two pieces of undoubtedly consequential legislation now that the president has, in fact, signed them into law?
The president actually hasn't yet signed those two controversial bits and pieces into law. He signed fire and felt legislation and a correctional services amendment legislation into law. The two controversial pieces of legislation you're talking about are among the 23 that he still has to sign in.
I'm sorry, I thought he'd just done it. Forgive me.
No. He started with the relatively uncontroversial ones, like the Feld fire and forest combating legislation and the correctional services amendments, which were required because of a constitutional court judgment. Look, I wouldn't want to be the president. I mean, the NHI is going to be awfully tricky for him to sign into law because it will go to court. That's what everybody says, from organized business to political parties. Of course, for the ANC, his party that he belongs to, it's great because they can go on the election campaign trail to say, here we have the NHI, quality access, universal access to quality healthcare for everyone, free of charge at the point of service. It's been a long-standing election and a policy promise. The Electoral Matters Amendment Bill is, I would think, even more awkward. The basic version is that because we now have independents contesting national and provincial elections, the electoral matters law had to be amended to bring independent candidates into, for example, political funding regime, disclosing the political funding regime. All of it fairly technical, fairly straightforward, except, of course, Home Affairs Minister Aaron Motsoaledi sneaked in something that has got everybody upset, which is he changed the funding formula of political parties. As you know, all our political parties that are represented in the legislatures provincially and nationally get a certain amount of money from the state purse. Now, that used to be 2/3 equitable, depending on how many MPs and MPLs a party has, 1/3 a flat share, that everybody got the same. Now, when the Electoral Matters Amendment Bill was tabled in Parliament, Aaron Motsoaledi, as Home Affairs Minister, sneaked in that it must change. 90% equitable and only 10% everyone gets the same. And of course, the ANC will benefit and so will the DA, but the DA joined the opposition parties because all of them would have lost key state funding for their operations literally weeks before the elections. And that's the controversial bit. And that is where the opposition parties, the multi-party charter members also have written to the president, please don't sign the bill into law. If you do, and this is an option that he has also, consider signing the bill into law except for that changed funding formula. We're still waiting to see. However, having said all of that, it is quite an indictment that there are 23 bills still sitting on the president's desk, because it basically means there's a huge bottleneck. Parliament does its work, produces the laws, public participation, public consultation, all of that done. And then it all comes to a grinding halt in the presidency. And the policy and the legislative changes that these laws are meant to introduce stop, because the president is not signing the legislation into force. To have 23 bills in the presidential in-tray at this stage, so close to the elections, and a change of parliament, a whole new crop of parliamentarians coming in, a change potentially in the union buildings and in cabinet. It's like, wow, it is a serious backlog, and I think we should all be concerned about that.
Would all the bills that were passed but not signed, when the new parliament comes into being, would they still be bills that could be signed into law, does the clock start all over again?
No. Luckily, they're all done and dusted. Parliament has done what it needs to do. They are in the presidential in-tray. That's where they will stay. And it's up to the president. Hopefully he'll sign them sooner and later, because, yes, we're in weird situations. So we have the General Intelligence Law Amendment Bill that's still coming up. But one aspect of the telephone bugging, has already been dealt with, the RICA Amendment Bill that is still sitting in the president's in-tray, I think, for about 3-4 months now, and he hasn't signed it. So now the General Intelligence Laws Amendment Bill is talking and is referencing the RICA Bill Act, which has been changed, and the law that's changing the RICA Act is ready, is in the presidential in-tray, but it's not been put into force. So we're now processing a law in parliament that has a wrong cross-reference to a law to which the Constitutional Court declared sections invalid. I know it sounds terribly complicated, and in many ways it is, but it is part and parcel of the consequences of what happens when there is a bottleneck in the presidency when it comes to signing bills into effect.
It sounds to me more than complex or complicated. It sounds either inept or diabolically Machiavellian. I'm not quite sure which, but it's got to be one or the other.
Look, I mean, we will see the consequences of this. For example, if we pass the General Intelligence, or if Parliament, it's now in the National Council of Provinces. So if the NCOP passes this General Intelligence Laws Amendment Bill, it passes legislation that has a wrong reference to another piece of law in it, and the logic would dictate that that law would actually have to go back to Parliament to be changed again. So you would have a General Intelligence Laws Amendment Bill.
Yeah, I have to ask you this question. I have a friend, an old friend of mine. He went to high school together, university together. He became a staff member and a couple of congressmen in the U.S. and then went off and became what is colloquially referred to as a lobbyist, where he made more money. But what he managed to show me over the years was you could track the circumstances and the precise circumstances, actually, of any bill introduced in the American Congress on software that showed you exactly where it was and what had happened and all of these things. Is there a similar kind of thing here? And do you access it to keep track of all this stuff?
Yes, there is. And it is incredibly helpful. It's called the Parliamentary Monitoring Group, PMG. It's an NGO that was started about in the late 90s. And it set itself the task of exactly doing that, tracking legislation, and more importantly, also recording and transcribing committee meeting minutes, putting up documents that are available, and also audio of committee meetings, which is incredibly important. Parliament isn't doing it. An NGO is doing it, and the Parliamentary Monitoring Group is wow. I mean, they're making such a contribution and assisting also you, me, other people to have access to parliamentary records. And that, of course, is fantastic in terms of accountability and transparency. Because remember, up until COVID, when things in Parliament radically shifted to online and virtual proceedings at committee and plenaries, before that, pretty much everything was in person, in physical sittings. And, you know, so you couldn't just log in to YouTube to catch up on the committee meeting that dealt with, for example, the expropriation bill. You actually had to be there. So the Parliamentary Monitoring Group is playing an incredibly important role.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and Marion has explained to me how she keeps track of all this stuff. It isn't through some sort of clairvoyance or prestidigitation. There's actual software to go to it. That's good news. We'll be right back after this message, and we'll pick up where we left off.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host. And my guest today is Marion Merton. Logically enough, we call upon her beginning of Parliament and sort of in the middle and now right at the end of a session to get a sense of what in the world is going on with that mysterious body that meets in a theater that used to meet in the Parliament. I'm fascinated by this. I have to ask, what's going to happen to the Parliament building?
You know, I am keeping my eyes peeled on the 18th of April. According to the latest plans that were tabled to the Joint Standing Committee on the Financial Management of Parliament, which is basically the committee that supervises Parliament matters, the 18th of April is when the demolition work is meant to start. Demolition work obviously being the first phase of rebuilding Parliament. It has been over 2 years, and yes, it's changed things. And in many ways, because the sittings at best are hybrid, a lot of MPs log in virtually, they don't come here anymore. You know, I remember the precinct, the parliamentary precinct, as quite vibey. You'd always bump into people, you'd bump into people who work here. It's not that anymore. And it's a pity. So hopefully on the 18th of April, they say the work will start to build a new parliament, to reconstruct and rebuild. Let's hope it does so. It will take another 2 years at best. And, you know, as anybody who's renovated their houses or built houses, building time frames are quite flexible.
And cost and time, they both, yes. They're on an exponential curve upward. The longer it takes, the more it costs, the longer it takes.
Yeah, let's hope it starts.
The language of talking about parliaments, congresses, national assemblies usually uses the phrase the people's house, because it is where a country's representatives go to thrash out, to sometimes fight, sometimes even hit each other on the head about things that are consequential. And maybe in my mind, it might be better just to go to an entirely online system and let anybody in the country log in to watch that instead.
Look, I must admit, going online has its benefits. I always chuckle because I do remember about 15 years ago or so, there were big discussions about whether Parliament should not invest in video conferencing facilities. So the DGs and the officials from Pretoria didn't have to come to Pretoria, from Pretoria to Cape Town, because that costs a lot of money.
I remember that.
Parliament kind of didn't quite get it together to get that done. So when we had the COVID lockdown from early 2020, and then obviously it was exacerbated with the fire because, you know, nobody could come back to Parliament, it was actually quite amazing how quick the transition was made, how quick online meetings became possible, how the doors, if you had data, and, you know, if you had data is important qualifier in South Africa, where data is quite expensive for a majority of people, but you could tune into YouTube. And it's amazing. It's taken something away, and this is why I would caution against going fully online. On the one level, what it has taken away is the personal interaction between MPs across the aisle of the House, of MPs of various political parties, basically meeting up after a long day, having a drink, having a coffee, chatting. Because it is in those personal interactions, face-to-face interactions, that give rise to compromises to solution finding if you're stuck somewhere in a law, in a committee, and you have that personal interaction, you come up with an idea, and you know, the legislation can go on or the appointments can go on. So with going online, that has fallen away largely, and you can see it. Because one of the things, there's fascinating studies around. So for example, if people go on social media, suddenly they have not the normal inhibitions that you and I in a personal face-to-face conversation would have. One of the outcomes of that is an explosion of online social media bullying. So some of those dynamics also then happen when you have online sessions. On another level, we've seen a loss of transparency and accountability in a weird way, even though it's now online. When MPs vote, be that on a controversial law or, for example, on appointing a Inspector General of Intelligence or a Deputy Public Protector or a Public Protector, or voting for the removal of a judge, you have, you know, so when people vote, the general way of doing it is that the chief whip will stand up in the House, will count, I've got 20 people in the House, 20 people online, we are 40 people voting against, voting in favor, which is fine. It sort of does the job. But previously, when there were physical sittings, the MPs pushed a button on their desks and individual votes were recorded. So you could see exactly MP so-and-so voted yes on this. And the votes were recorded in the ATC, the announcement tablings and committee reports. So there was a public track record. So we can go back, say, 6 years, 7 years, and we can look at the ATC and the Hansa, and we can see these are the MPs who supported a no confidence motion in Jacob Zuma. These are the MPs who voted against. And that's very important for accountability and transparency. And that has fallen away. So all we now have is that so and so many votes for, so and so many votes against.
This is Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive, and Mariette Merton is my guest today, explaining the secret chambers and institutions of your National Assembly. We'll be right back after this.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is Brooke Spector, of course, with The Deep Dive, and our guest, Mariette Merton, who has the insight. She has the secret code. She knows the secret handshake to understand the parliament. You were talking about the gain and the loss of parliamentary life because of this hybrid, half online, half in-person business. One of the criticisms in the U.S. about Congress now is that because of the more hyper political nature of the division between the two major parties is that members across the aisle no longer get together after a session or a meeting to have a drink, have a cup of coffee, shout, scream at each other in good fun. And too often members are now rushing to get home for the weekend because people go back. If they meet in Washington, they need to get to an airport, which is 20 minutes away, if you're lucky, to rush to get home to their home district, see their family, which may not live in Washington or nearby anymore, and to do the essentials of politicking and speaking at Rotary clubs and raising money for the next campaign. But here, the system is a little different. You're pointing to the fact that there has become, by virtue of the advances of technology, a sort of a watering down of the ability to mix and mingle and thrash through ideas among members of different political affiliations. Is there a way to change that? Is there a way to heal that, fix it?
Absolutely. Parliament must come back and sit fully in physical form with everybody being present. It will be, I think it will be taking a bit of time because the last, and it has been 4 years of largely online meetings, have now entrenched a kind of what you outlined in terms of the US scenario, a lot more hardened attitudes. It will take a little bit of time to break that down. Look, I think maybe the 2024 election outcomes might assist, especially if we are looking at coalition situations. But look, I mean, I remember, I mean, our politics and our parliament is loud and it's vocal and people heckle and all sorts of things. And sometimes people say nasty things and they get called to order and they have to withdraw. But at the end of a sitting, I mean, one would go to Barney's, which is what one of the pubs was called, and you'd find them sitting there, all quite chummy and all quite friendly and, you know, making jokes. And I think that is a quality that has been lost and that needs to come back, because in terms of our politics, it will help to get people out of their hard ideological dances. And, you know, I mean, I'm sure you know this better than I do. I mean, politics very often is the art of compromise. The bottom line is it's South Africans, ordinary people, who must be served. And nobody gets served by taking hard ideological stances, whether that's to the left or to the right or wherever you may find yourself. So, hey, yeah, I would like to have Parliament sit in full again, not losing the fact that committee meetings are recorded and you can follow them on YouTube also, because I think it is important to maintain that level of public access also. And I don't think it's a either or situation.
I want to ask you just very briefly, talk us through the circus that ensued over the appointment or selection of the deputy public prosecutor, public protector, excuse me.
The long and short of it is very simple. It is the outcome of the difficulty in finding excellent candidates for public positions like the public protector, the deputy public protector, a lot of the other statutory appointments to the Gender Commission, to ICASA and elsewhere. Regardless, in several committees that I've attended, looking to fill these statutory and constitutional appointments, MPs have complained about, one, not sufficient numbers are applying, wanting to do those positions, two, quality, maybe not the right word, the gravitas and the prestige of those who apply has been failing. So what we saw with this deputy public protector interviewing selection nomination process really has shown a very harsh and a very strong spotlight on this. The fact that the committee, the Justice Committee, has decided that given the situation, we actually cannot recommend anybody, I think that just says it all. And hopefully that can be reversed and ways can be found to attract people of gravitas and standing to apply for these jobs again.
Well, I hope so, too. And we will obviously ask Marion to come back and explain the new parliament once it's elected and how it's going to work and who's going to be in charge and why there are problems or possibilities. And I look forward to that opportunity again. As always, thanks very much. You understand this stuff. You explain it. And I feel so much better informed as a result.
Thank you very much for giving me the chance, Brooks. I much appreciate it. Take care.
This is Brooks Spector with Deep Dive. Thanks to Marion Merton, our guest. And we'll be back again next week, 9 o'clock on Friday morning. Thanks all.